sent something to the class about going to a meetup on system sciences. I put it on Blackboard announcement. And that was something that David had let me know about. So if you're interested in that, I think they do regular meetups. So please join that and get some networking opportunities with people with similar interests. So David's working on his PhD right now at Aalto University in Finland. He also has been an IBM person for 28 years. I was there for 22. David beats me by 6. So he has a huge amount of experience in as a service analyst, as somebody who's worked in with other companies, with other organizations, with the City of Toronto was a big, cities all across around the world, trying to understand how to make improvements and innovations within the service that they deliver. So he also, when he lectures, he is very interactive, so I encourage you to speak up and ask questions, especially in situations where he and I may have a different perspective, because we do, and that's an encouraged thing, so where we can actually have a little discussion and debate, I encourage you to engage with David in questions. Now, do you want me to turn the light on? Can you guys see him okay? Yeah. Okay, great. So thank you, David.
Thanks.
I'll let you go ahead.
Okay. So this talk is now available in a variety of places. So I went to Finland because it was a roundabout trip. I was actually going to a wedding in Brussels. My grad school friend got married for the first time. It's nice when someone after 30 years we got married. We went to his wedding. But then I went over to Finland. And I thought I was going to spend my time working on my dissertation and writing, which is actually apart from all this work. And then I got one of the invitation to give a talk at Aalto University, because I've been there so many times. It's now called the annual David Ng talk, which I think is a bit strange. But so I did another talk. But then what happened was that I discovered that one of my friends had moved. She was at University College London, Satu Terry Kangas, and she had moved back to Finland. And it's like, oh. And so which program does she lead? She's leading the industrial management program at Metropolia, which is a university of applied science. And it's where in 2006 we started doing international service business management program in the first place. So that said, oh, okay, can you come and give a talk there? And it's like, okay, well, I'll give a talk there. So I have this talk which summarizes the work that I've been doing over the past year and a half on what I call service system thinking. The slides are online, and you can find them on the website that's at coevolving.com. I can give the presentation slightly differently here than I gave it in Finland, because we have more people who have English as a first language here. So it'll be a little better. What I'm going to do, so on the website now, there's lots of videos. So there's two-hour lectures that I gave. This is one of the two-hour lectures. And so given Kelly's challenge, what I'm going to do is I'm going to give a completely different talk from the talk I gave on the same slides. And the way I'm going to do that is I'm actually going to start at the end, and I'm going to work my way through. So let me sort through here and go to the end. I like to challenge myself here.
Are you speak backwards too?
No, that would be a little too weird. Yeah. So I'm going to start here. Okay, so we'll start with the outline. The talk I typically give is, what could service system thinking be? And I propose the term service system thinking because it's a combination of a number of things. It's systems thinking, service science, management, engineering, and design, generative pattern language, it comes with Christopher Alexander's work in architecture, multiple perspectives, open collaboration, which is federated wiki, and then this last part, which I never gave a chance to talk to when I was giving the other talk. So I'm going to start here. Now this will be interesting, because this gets in really deep, really fast, and we have this idea of service science. So what do we mean by service science? And what is it we mean by science? This is a challenge I actually got when I was working with INCOSE, the International Council on Systems Engineering, and we formed this group called the System Science Working Group. So they're pretty good. The systems engineering community is very good about running projects. And so every 6 months they have a meeting, they document everything, the websites. If you search on the System Science Working Group, you'll find these sorts of things. They've also got an open discussion group where I hate the discussion that always goes, what's a system, and what do you mean by a system, and all sort of stuff. But in response to that, in talking about trying to define what system science was, I ended up having to define what I meant by science. Okay. Now, system science, the history of system science turns out to be a very strange definition, which I've now documented and had validated, which was system science, originally the society that I work with, now the International Society of System Sciences, used to be called the Society for General Systems Research. So this idea of general systems theory had come out before. But then the group changed over and they got this name International Society of System Sciences. And you go, well, where is system science? How much science has there been in systems? This sort of stuff. And the history actually goes back to Russell Acuff moving to University of Pennsylvania and starting a new program, which he wanted to call something different. So he ended up calling it social system science. And why did he call it social system science? If you've ever dealt with the politics of a university, you have to get a name in. It was the most awkward name he could think of, and he thought no one would ever use it. And so system science came out of social system science as a term because he hoped no one would ever use the term social system science. And so there are a few people with a PhD in social system science from University of Pennsylvania, but that's the history of it. So when people go, oh, system scientists, let's go back into into the 1950s, so that, no, system sciences actually was a term that came out in the 1970s. So, what do we actually mean by system science, though? Going back and looking at Aristotle, we can talk about systems in three ways, where the primary intellectual value is either episteme, techne, or phronesis. Okay, how many people have heard of episteme, epistemology? How many people have heard of techne? How many people have heard of phronesis? Nobody, right. So this is part of the challenge we have in defining science. And mostly when we're in universities, we tend to talk about episteme in terms of science and epistemology, which is around knowledge. But techne is around craft. So you talk about technicians, you talk about people building things, technique. There's this third sense of phronesis that is prudence or common sense. And it turns out that Aristotle thought that phronesis was the one you're supposed to aim for. So this is part of a paper that I published, but the references are all there. You can go back and you end up with, well, what's that mean? Well, so if you're doing episteme, you're doing analytic scientific knowledge. Analytic means you're taking things apart. Okay. Technical knowledge, how is it you actually do things? And phronesis, practical ethics. So practical ethics are being nice to other people because it's nice to you, they're nice to you, that sort of thing. It's practical. You know, if you're mean to people, they're mean to you. That's practical. Right? Orientation, how do you get episteme? You do research. How do you do techne? You get production. And how do you get phronesis? You get action. So if you're looking for a theory of action, should you be doing episteme? Should you be doing research, right? And you run into these issues that the nature of the research you do, when you're looking at episteme and you're looking at science, you want universals. When I drop this apple, it always falls to the ground, right? It's invariable in time and space, always true, and it's context independent. So no matter where I stand on the earth, you drop this apple, it falls. When looking at techne, it's different. It's a pragmatic sort of orientation. Does it work? Now, thinking about this, what are the practical methods that we had, and where I come from in having this talk is, I come from a period where there used to be something called the IBM Global Services Method. And people don't think about it very much because when it kind of went up and then it went down, people don't do it anymore. It's unfortunate because it's great work. But the idea there was really pragmatic, that you had these problems or tasks you had to do, and how do you coordinate? And how do you coordinate on a worldwide level? So if IBM is dealing with General Motors, and it has a project that's a services project, that project has to be executed uniformly around the world, which means that there's going to be people in Japan, there's going to be people in Detroit, there's going to be people in Europe and Germany, and they're also to be doing the same thing together. How is it they actually generate that? So the ideas here are variable in time and space. The consulting, it depends answer. And it's very context dependent. So there are, if you're doing information technology development project, are you going to do rapid application development? Are you going to do agile? Are you going to do waterfall? Well, it actually depends when you get onto the client site, because the client has, if the client has no experience doing agile, that's going to be pretty tough for you to do that project. You have to bridge them. So there's a context there. You run into the same sort of issues with phronesis, because that's variable in time and space, always context dependent. So there's no such thing as an ultimate solution if you're trying to find ultimate justice or create a new policy. It depends on the people it's going to impact. So the pursuit, science is always about uncovering universal truth. Technique, instrumental rationality towards a conscious goal. This is goal-oriented. You don't do methods unless you have a goal. And then phronesis, which is values and practice based on judgment and experience. So judgment and experience means that different people will perceive a service in different ways. The colloquial way I describe this, epistem, know why. Technique, know how. And when you say know how, it helps to think it's not just one person knowing how, it's multiple people knowing how. And then phronesis is know when, know where, and know whom. So if you take a method and you just apply the method without looking at the context, you could get it in the wrong, using it at the wrong time, the wrong place, and the wrong people. So this is a backdrop for thinking about services, because if we're doing services research, what are we doing? Are we actually doing all epistem? Or are there other things we should be looking at? What does it mean to do research in services? What's the science of services mean? Questions? Comments?
So based on this, I think the name of the course should be changed from Introduction to Service Science to Introduction to Service Science and Craft.
And you don't care whether it impacts people or doesn't impact people.
Well, I just didn't know how to add that. Introduction to Service Science, Craft, and Prudence. Sounded inappropriate. It's implied because we're in the I school.
Yeah. Okay, so we'll start off on the deep end here.
So we really do, I hope, do some, we look at the, you know, the uncovering some universal truths through some of the readings, but your assignments are all more based in the technique, the craft piece of it, really trying to apply that in some context-dependent fashion, the service system that you've picked to work on.
And there may be, if you're looking towards emancipatory issues, so, you know, if you want a society that is just and equal, everyone's, you know, has access to information, you're now into phronesis.
Which we are in the I school, very much so, right? So maybe I should make it explicit. Okay. Thank you.
So, with that broad definition of science, I'm going to jump over, this way I get the problem of looking into, starting at the end, so starting in the middle. I'm going to talk eventually about pattern language and architecture. And the question is, why would I do that? There is a form in the pattern language, and I'll just be quick about it. A pattern is a solution to a problem in context. A pattern is a solution to a problem in context, which sounds a lot like you're starting to get towards phronesis, right? It's not about universals. There's a context at play. So it could be methods, it could be phronesis, but you run into this question now. So the word context comes into play. And then you have the words of problem and solution. And there's a challenge in using the words problem and solution, and I'll get to the system thinking part, because when you're thinking of a problem, for a systems thinker, there's not a single problem. There is a system of problems. A system of problems is called, in French, problématique. And so if when you have a solution, you fix part of the problem, but you don't really fix it. So when I was looking at some of the history about, you know, why architects work and how they work, we came up with this idea of problem seeking. And problem seeking is part of what was called architectural programming. And we end up with trying to differentiate between architecture and design. But essentially, the idea was that there was a problem seeking phase that architects would do. There was a problem solving phase that designers would do. And then you have a solution. So does anyone want to try to differentiate between architecture and design? Any, we have any architects here? Information architects?
Aspiring information architects.
If you're aspiring information architects, then how is it different from information design?
I think I'll get it wrong. I think a lot of you have a better sense than I do.
Go ahead, give it a try.
Okay. So, an architect, an architectural part is more about the patterns, and design is more about the specific application of that in a particular situation.
Does anyone agree, disagree with that?
I would guess that information architects lay like the foundation, so like the structure for it, and design is more sort of like how it appears and how it's designed.
Okay.
Wow, it doesn't give much away, does it?
Anyone else want to give a try?
Just tell us already.
So, if you, in the way that they thought about this, with the design as problem solving, programming is architectural programming. It's problem seeking. When you are doing architecture work, you are trying to create. You're trying to find the problems to be solved. You're not solving the problems. So as an architect, what problems are you supposed to be solving? Because after you've put out the envelope, then the designer is constrained. Right? So if the designer is constrained, and you're putting around this envelope, then your job as architect is to try to constrain the designer the least amount as possible. Or it should be. So if let's go back to the analogy of a building, because that's what people normally think about. So can you design a building where it doesn't constrain the designer inside?
Architect a building.
Architect a building. That's a pretty tricky call.
I don't think it would be possible.
Okay, so I have a friend, David Hawk, who's systems thinker. Turns out he's Russ Acoff's first PhD student when we talk about social system science. So he's an architect and a management professor. And so he designed a house. And one of the things that he designed about the house is he told, so first there were no blueprints to the house. 4,000 square foot house, it turns out to be, no blueprints.
How is that possible?
How is that possible?
Yes.
He believes in he's the ultimate believer in what you might call empowerment. So the first thing you do is you go find a person that builds foundations.
Yeah.
And you say, I'd like to build a house. And the guy says, how big do you want it to be? And he says, how big do you think it should be? Well, you know, it depends what you want to do with it. Now you have a conversation about it, right?
Yeah.
Because if you tell the builder how big the house is going to be, you're constraining him. Right? So then he had this rule, which was he had all the workmen, like he had carpenters, he had all these guys. He's paying these guys time and materials, actually. So it's not like a fixed price contract, actually time and materials. but he it would say, I want you to build a space and make it a great space. And they kind of go, well, what's the function of this room? And he goes, I haven't decided yet. What do you think the function should be?
How many years did it take to build this house?
Oh, no, it went up in a year.
Huh?
Yeah, it's not a problem. Yeah.
But I mean, at some point, there would have had to be...
Well, not necessarily decision.
Yeah, like, everyone would have to work together at a certain point.
Sure.
To make some kind of decision. Because, I mean,
yeah.
A decision isn't constrained, I suppose.
As soon as you make a decision, you do constrain. You constrain everybody else coming after you.
Yeah.
Yeah. So at a certain point, you have to have the structure in. And then you're going to have the plumbing and the electrical. You probably want the plumbing and electrical in before you put, all the walls in. But then you're going to go, well, how many electrical outlets do you need? It's like, well, I don't know. We haven't decided what the function of the room is yet. So
it's not just number. It's things like height and like the height of the electrical outlet.
Well, there are standards.
A bathroom or a kitchen versus if it's like in your living room.
No, but you're also dealing with the common sense of the people that have done, like, these guys are like 10, 20 years carpenters and electricians and plumbers. You tell, I want to put in plumbing. It's like, they're not going to do a bad job, right? You just tell them, they should do this, right?
So if you had a client as a consultant, you go in and you say to the client, if that's how you responded to everything, wouldn't you run into problems? At some point, doesn't somebody need to make a decision?
Okay.
And
so
constrain the problem so that it actually can be, a solution can be developed?
So let me describe the way that IBM Consulting Group, I was trained as an IBM consultant. I'm certified as a consultant. In 1994, I took all the training. So the way that the IBM Global Services method was created was there were work products. And so we're going to create work products. And so a client comes in and says, I have this business problem. Okay, for you, we're going to create these work products, and here's the list. And the guy says, that bill's too high, twice as much. Okay, which work products would you like to remove? Because we can shave a little bit, but either you want it or you don't want it. So do you want a bathroom or you don't want a bathroom, right? And we can discuss how many bathrooms you're going to have, but if you want like lots of bathrooms, we're probably going to need bigger pipes. If you don't know, then maybe the construction guy is actually going to put the larger pipes because he doesn't yet know, right? So maybe over-designed.
So would you say that's the problem-seeking part? Here's all the work products.
Yes.
Pick the ones you want or don't want.
Yes, yes.
And then that turns into, once you've selected them, then you've constrained the designer to fit to that.
Well, maybe or maybe not. Depends on the change. So this is very close to the work on agile development. How many people have done agile development? Okay, so you've done agile development. That's actually what this is about. Because what you're trying to do is find out what is of value to the customer, to the product owner, right? And so they kind of go, well, I don't know, I haven't seen it. And so you build a little bit, so to come back like within usually 2 weeks, 3 weeks, and say, show them something and say, is that it? Are we getting close? And then if it's of value, you're doing that. So you're actually doing architecture, not in the traditional sense of coming in and building stuff, coming in and blueprinting stuff, but you're actually constructing things in reality. So they can look at it and go, well, that's kind of right. So they start digging a hole, and it's like, how big is this house supposed to be? Well, I don't know how it's supposed to be. Well, how many bedrooms do you want? Well, it's supposed to be like a conference center. But it's not like a huge conference center, not a commercial conference center. You have people come and they have meetings here. Well, how many people would you have in a meeting? I don't know, maybe not more than 20 people, maybe 10 people stay overnight. Okay, if you need that, then is that going to fit in like a 2,000 square foot house? Probably not. 3,000 square foot, I don't know. So now you start going negotiating back and forth. And when you do that, that creates this question now about the problem seeking. What problem is worth working on? So is there a risk for you over-designing the size of the house? Don't know. It's like you have these discussions. And people make decisions based off binary sorts of answers. You do this, do that. All right.
Don't you think most people know what their problem is before they called the consultant?
No.
They don't?
No. No, I had a whole career at IBM based on all of that. My most fun job, so I was a consultant between 1990...
They must know what they want to accomplish. They must know...
Mm-hmm. So between 1994 and 2006, I was a consultant at IBM, and then I went to IBM Software Group, and here's my favorite client. Client says, okay, IBM, here's a check for $1 million. By the way, what am I buying? And why am I doing this? The money's right here. I can sign this check for $1 million, IBM, but what am I buying and what's it for? And I did that for 4 years. I did what I call business value assessments, where I go and look at the technologies, I look at the business problems, and so I end up with really fun projects. One of the projects I end up with that I've spoken about in this class before was, what does City Hall do with Google and Twitter? IBM. What does City Hall do with Google and Twitter? They started as a project in Addison, Texas, and it's like, okay, we're going to do business with IBM. It's fine, but we don't know what it is we're supposed to be doing with Twitter and Facebook, all this sort of stuff. And when we did the study, it turns out that in Addison, Texas, what they're most interested in is economic development. Addison, Texas is on the north part of Dallas. All of Dallas was dry. This is where all the bars and hotels and restaurants were. So anything that will help the restaurants and hotels, that's what they want to do. We did the study at the same time with the City of Toronto and the Region of Peel. So what would the City of Toronto want? They wanted citizen engagement. They don't care about economic development when you start ranking down the list. They want citizen engagement. That's why they want social media. In the Region of Peel, what did they want? The reason they wanted the technologies was internal communications, because they've got a really big territory and people will come into the office. And so they all agreed that these are all important things, but the priorities are completely different. So what problem are you solving? Are you solving civic engagement? Are you solving economic development? That's not to say they aren't all important, but you have to seek the problem. You have to define the problem you want the focus on.
Okay, I'm just going to say one more thing.
Good.
I think the problem, in my terminology, in what you just described, is what are we going to do with Google and Twitter? I understand that isn't really the problem.
That isn't really the problem.
It isn't.
Yeah.
But they knew they needed something. They just didn't know what the problem was.
Well, they could have done nothing.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. And City Hall in Toronto, they have more or less done nothing.
So they what?
They have more or less done nothing in terms of... For the priority that they came up with, which was... They wanted citizen engagement. They haven't done much, because when you get down into, trying to make it all constituent stuff like that, it's pushing and shoving, it may not happen. Yeah. Yes?
So can we say that architecture is more about the requirements, while the problem or the design is about the how, the way the requirements are realized?
Nope. I spent pretty well my whole career trying to expunge the word requirement. Because to me, there's no such thing as a requirement. There are things the only reason you would have a requirement is if it is legally required. So you have to pay your taxes. You're working at a restaurant. You have inspections and all that sort of stuff. But most of the things in business and most of the things in the world are not mandated. It's kind of live long and prosper sort of stuff. So you have your own choice. When you're doing agile development, agile does not use the word requirement. We never use the word requirement. It's a story that you're working on, and you show the client. The client likes it, doesn't like it. You do an iteration on it. Okay. So the reason you're doing programming, this architectural programming, is because you end up in this loop. Typically, if you were doing waterfall methodology, as we call it today, this is an architect's way of looking at it, was that if you try to do a drawing, a blueprint for a building, and you get the program input wrong, then you end up having to redesign everything, and you go around the circle, and it's just inefficient to do that sort of thing.
But programming here, you mean something bigger than coding, obviously.
Programming, yes. And so this is the interesting part about programming and the way it's been used, is that programming is supposed to be like program, as in it's not a computer program, it's an architectural program, all right? Or you could talk about when you artistic program. So programming, as people have thought about it, has really been taken down to coding now. But maybe we should think about programming, the original sense of programming, which was, this is what it meant in the 1970s. The problem you have when you're dealing with this, and this comes down to the word with the requirements issue, is that the client comes in with all of these ideas, and it's up to the architect to try to rationalize or work his way through those ideas. And some of them just aren't, they're spurious, like they really don't make an impact on the architecture, but other ones do. And so sorting through that's an issue. Now, one of the things, and this is funny, is 1969, Penny and Folke. The idea that the client should always be involved with the architect was a new idea in 1969. That you should actually have the client involved in the problems that they want to work on. Not just solving the problems, but actually in the programming of that. Okay. So I'm going to jump over now to IT. People know about waterfall? Everyone knows about waterfall? I actually prefer, waterfall is a bit of a pejorative term. It actually should be called more structured methods. So in 1970, in the large scale development project, this is where these things this first came out. So here's the idea, someone working on NASA type projects, right? You do system requirements, which drive out, so there's hardware and software there, which drive out software requirements, which drive out analysis, which drives out program design, coding, testing, and operations. That's the order that things happen. And that's the way it's supposed to work, right? And so it's hopefully the iterative interaction between various phases is confined to successive steps. The actual way that you're supposed to do this stuff is you do no software requirements until you've done the system requirements. You do no analysis work until you've completed the software requirements. You do no design work until you've finished the analysis. We're talking about NASA, we're talking about moonshot type of things, right? Now this is the problem, is that you end up having to back up. So if testing fails, you're going to have to do a redesign, which means you're going to go back here, and you're technically only supposed to go back one step. The full waterfall structured approaches that we have are only supposed to go back one step at a time, but what happens, you end up going back two steps, and then you have going all the way back to the beginning, and this is the problem we have when you're trying to define things. So if you're trying to do a design and implementation of a system, working harder on blueprints may or may not help. Usually it doesn't. Right? And so this problem, 1970, it's not like we didn't know this was coming. When it blows out, you end up with, here's the solution, here's the problem, here's a solution, which is to do multiple iterations. You're supposed to build little components and then go back and cycle and cycle and cycle and cycle, and so that was the way that system was supposed to be developed. Now, this is coming from software development, but these guys are close enough, we're talking systems. And remember, I'm talking about service system thinking. So we're talking about service systems, right? There's not much difference between thinking about a service system and a software system here in terms of methods. We're into technique now. So what we can do instead is to lower risk, more documentation, the complete program designs recommended for analysis of coding. Now this one is not the way that we actually do it in practice today. But if you're going to follow this method, then it means that you actually have to plan out the project and do it step by step. Complete the program design before analysis coding begins. Documentation must be current and complete. Do the job twice if possible. Document it twice before you write anything. Testing must be planned, controlled, and monitored, and well, the customer. So, we have this idea of agility. This is 2006. This is from the Open Unified Method, which is part of the Eclipse idea, the Eclipse project. And they have the idea of waterfall. If there is few risks, sequential, late integration and testing. There's iterative, which is risk-driven, continuous integration and testing. And you have high ceremony, which is well-documented, has little traceability chain control boards on it. And they have low ceremony, which is light documentation, light process. So when we're talking about agility, agility was supposed to be in this area. It's supposed to be iterative, and it's supposed to be low ceremony. Low ceremony means less documentation, less structure. People have more tasks, whole tasks to work on, right?
And if you're building a nuclear reactor, you want to be in the upper right corner.
You want to, yes, because the risk is too high.
And so if we translate this to systems design, like service system design,
mm-hmm.
and architecture, can you give an example maybe of an organization or maybe one of the city changes that you talked about here? Once you define the problem of how to use Google and Twitter in Texas, for example, to help with business development, how did they implement then that change in their system through this kind of thing? Or did you leave them? Good luck with that. My work is done.
I did leave, actually. Yeah. They did implement it. They got a business partner to do it. But the interesting part for them was who gets engaged. And so they were engaged very much in with the local business owners and in developing festivals. Festivals are one of the big things, Rib Fest sort of stuff.
Right.
And so how do you design a system to do that? Because City Hall normally didn't get involved in that sort of planning.
Right. And so an example that I would think of for in my life, now as associate dean academic, right? Suppose we look at all of our programs as service systems, and we want to identify innovations within these programs. So one of the things that we have just implemented is a combined program. So someone taking the Interactive Digital Media undergraduate BA can apply to early registration within our program. They get an MI, they get a conditional acceptance to the MI program, and then, so we've implemented this little change in our service system through the IDM program, and we're doing some iterative light doc. Don't tell the students that, of course. We want them to do that. And the hope is that we'll learn from that and then be able to, maybe we'll extend it beyond that. But rather than saying a wholesale number, we'll design the heck out of a whole bunch of undergraduate combined programs with us. We'll do an agile kind of design change within our system, service system, and work it out that way. And if it, depending on how it goes, we'll expand it. I'm just trying to think of an example for what David's talking about, how this software system development model applies in a service system.
Let me give an example.
A better one.
A better example. So in Finland, where I've been doing grad studies since 2003, they have this essential challenge that they want world-class professors to come and visit, but they don't. You can't get a professor to visit Finland for a year. Like, it's just a lot of effort. So what they did is they changed the program, and they offer courses that run 2 weeks. And so it's Tuesday, Thursday, full days. Professor flies in. The professor sends a reading list in ahead. Professor comes in, lectures for those days. It's either 4 or 5 full days, depending how you do it, and flies out, and they do the homework afterwards. That's an agile way of getting knowledge. You can actually get a professor to come in for 2-3 weeks. Kelly is interested in going to Finland, but, go to Finland for 2 or 3 weeks, do an entire course, and then fly out. That's a practical way of doing it. And then you go, well, the university's not set up to do that. We do 13 weeks, we do 10 weeks. You go, yeah, why? Does it make a difference? So that was a much more agile way of doing it.
Right. So for assignment three, where you look at an innovation in your service system, think about this kind of a way in which you could, I almost think of it as test the waters a bit, you know, and think of innovations that you could implement in this iterative way. Maybe it'll work. Okay.
Just because you're agile doesn't mean it won't scale. There's a lot of methods to do this. There's a method that's called disciplined agile delivery that IBM was working on. And they open sourced a lot of the stuff in the Eclipse process framework. And so there's a whole vocabulary around methodology. This is the techy stuff. So this is not epistem, and it's not phronesis. In effect, if people really want to know what IBM Global Services method was, IBM open sourced it, and it's in the Eclipse framework. And this is the way the project should run. Now also, you can do this with action research. People done action research methods? Oh. This is what I get for crossing back over the Atlantic.
Well, yeah, because it's very common in
Europe. Yeah, but it's not very common here.
No.
So if you are trying to, if you don't necessarily have the goal of epistem, but you're looking for technical phronesis and you're looking for a learning loop, how is it that that would work legitimately? So what you do is you diagnose the problem. Now this action research typically means that you are in the project. So you're doing, as an example, a software development project, you're doing agile. The customer comes, has a lot of money, wants a new marketing system of some sort, doesn't know what exactly it is. Okay, what you do is define the problem. You do some action planning, alternative course of action for solving a problem, take the action, evaluate, study the consequences of the action. Now this is the part where people actually fall down when they do action research, is that you actually put the look at the consequences. When you took that action, what happened? And what are the consequences of it? So Agile does this pretty well. You built something, and you now bring it to the client, and the client goes, that's really wonderful, that's what I asked for, but that's not what I really need, right? So you specify the learning. This is what you actually should do formally, which is, okay, this guy said that the problem was not the problem it was, we need to redefine the problem again. So there's a whole body of work around action research that's done, and it is a scientific method for learning about learning. Okay. I'm going to go back to the beginning because this talk that I've been giving, there's various versions of it. I've been going across, firstly, the systems engineering community. I was working with IZIP. You've told people what IZIP, right?
I have.
Have you? The International Society for Service Innovation Professionals?
I'll tell you about it. I should have told you.
So this is the organization that focuses on services. System science community, I went to the pattern language community. Relating system thinking and design is a research group out of OCAD and the School of Architecture in Oslo. And then I was at the pattern language conference in the past summer.
I did tell you about the human side of service engineering. Remember, that's the one that takes place during my wedding anniversary every year. And it's when I was in San Francisco, David came to, it was my 25th wedding anniversary.
Yeah.
So it's not a good one for me.
Okay. So I'm going to go back to the beginning now.
So from your perspective, what I'm hearing is that when you look at service systems and try to apply or try to come up with ways to design and architect and design and make changes within service systems, you're really borrowing from software systems methods and applying them in those systems.
Yeah, so what happens is that most of the software stuff comes out of the research into the pattern language stuff. And so now I'm going to back up and go all the way back to the beginning and start over.
Because one of the readings that we did this week was Steve Alter's work systems.
Okay.
And so I don't know if you have a commentary on the relationship between the work systems framework and...
To me, it's techni, it's not phronesis.
Oh, I agree. I agree with that.
Yeah. Okay. So there is a paper that actually describes pretty well everything I'm going to do in this talk. I presented this a year ago at the PLOP conference, Pattern Language and Programming Conference, which originally, the PLOP conference is one of the ACM conferences, and it's where all the people that originally did Agile and Patterns used to be, and it's now like 20 years later. And the format normally they have is they have people come and you present patterns, which I'll explain in a moment, and use like one or two pages, and I showed up with a 40-page paper that was incomplete with an audience of Japanese graduate students. So they're all reading this as English second language. So there is a paper that actually says most of what I'm going to tell you. I'm going to try to not put you through that pain. I'm going to start off with this idea of what services and things could be. And there's an intentional representation, object process representation of this. So, what could service system thinking be? It could be a resource that applied by service scientists, managers, engineers, and designers. And so I actually use I-star notation.
Some people here may have heard of that because the inventor of it is Eric Yu, and he's a professor.
Yep, okay. Now this is kind of fun to work through. You have position covers roles, agent plays a role, you have soft goals, you have tasks, resources, that sort of stuff. So I was thinking this through, and so we have a service beneficiary, a service provider, and they work together, and if you have a service scientist, they would want to improve the understanding, map natural history, validate mechanisms, and make predictions. You have a service manager, wants to improve the capabilities, define progress. These are actually Jim's board definitions. Service engineer, improve control and optimize resources. Service designer, improve experience and explore possibilities. But does that mean that there are four different domains? And I'm going, well, actually, if you want to cross them, then you have to use system thinking perspective. You need something that kind of ties them all together. Now, alternatively, I could do this with an object process representation. Object process methodology has been an alternative within the systems engineering community. The way that the systems engineers had worked was they have what's called SysML. SysML is a derivation of the object languages, right? And they took it over. But a lot of the systems engineers hate it. And so they have this much simpler thing, which is objects are rectangles, processes are ovals, and they have various ways of drawing these things together. So they have agent handles a process with a dot, and the object exhibits a property with a double arrow. And so here I have service system thinking is something that's done by a service thinking community.
So you're using these normative modeling techniques to represent service systems thinking?
Yes.
Okay. But you could also use these to represent the system itself.
The system itself.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Okay. So service system thinking is composed of systems thinking, which is a process. There's a body of work of service science, management, engineering, and design. So that's actually a structure as an object. Generative pattern languages tend to be structures. And the multiple perspectives open collaboration is actually a process. So the thing I like about OPM is it actually makes you stop and think, is that an object or is that a process?
Which one?
Object process methodology.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah,
yeah.
For each of them, you have to think, is it an object or a process? Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
A noun or a verb.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm going to talk a little bit about systems thinking. This is the set to level set, everyone. I'll try to go through this relatively quickly. There are some basic ideas that have come through. I'm actually going to skip the last one, but I'm going to talk about wholes and parts and then talk about evolving and learning. So the challenge I see with systems thinking is it practically died in like 1990s. There was this world in the 1960s, 1980s, and system thinking was a big field at that point. And now we're in this new world, and I think that there has to be some learning or co-evolving of system thinking as a field. First, I have to describe what I mean by system thinking. So here's the definition. Probably the only definition you get out of me. I always cite other people. System thinking is a perspective on wholes, parts, and their relations. So this is a very, very general idea. It's true in most cultures. People understand parts, they understand wholes, and you end up using the language in systems across cultures because it's so old. There are some basic ideas. There is function, which is contribution of the part to the whole. So you have a part, and you have a function. If it's non-living, you call it a function. If it's a living thing, you call it a role. But there's a containing whole around the part. That's function. Structure is the arrangement in space. Process is the arrangement in time. That's pretty well all the system thinking terminology you need to know. And the skill testing question, which comes first, structure or process? It took me 8 years in the society before I got an answer to that one. Okay. Do people, does anyone agree or disagree?
Structure is really because it's like the information architecture thing that you were talking about. So it's building seeing what exactly the future problems and everything. So you're building the structure and then you're solving it through processes.
Okay. Anyone disagree with that? Anyone think the process comes first?
You can have the process come first and then you can rearrange the structure to make the process go easier.
So form is structure, or is form process?
Sorry, form is structure, function is process.
Okay, so the answer to this is process comes first. And why does process come first? Because structure is the slowest changing process ever. So you think of a mountain as a structure, but a mountain changes as well. It depends on what time scale you're on. And we have time as a one-way arrow, second law of thermodynamics with entropy. So process is actually what comes first, or structure.
Say again why? Because structure moves slowly?
Because structure is the slowest changing process ever.
Slowest changing process.
Okay. Yes. Yeah. And so this is one of the things when you're doing system design, is that people don't necessarily think about designing in time. And if you're an architect, then you actually should be designing in time. So the structure can actually change, but what happens is time becomes a bigger challenge. Okay. There's good system thinking and there's bad system thinking. Or more technically, authentic system thinking. Synthesis precedes analysis. And the containing whole is appreciated. So synthesis is putting things together. Analysis is taking things apart. So if you're doing good system thinking, you're putting things together before you take them apart. This is Rednikoff's definition. So we have the part here, we have the containing whole. Firstly, identify the containing whole system of which the thing to be explained is a part. The way I normally describe this is, let's think about a transit system, let's think about a streetcar, okay? Streetcar is a part, okay? How do you explain that part? Well, you explain it in terms of the containing whole. So don't take the streetcar apart and say, well, there's a driver in it, it's got wheels, it's got power and all sorts of stuff. What you do is look at the containing whole. The containing whole is the transportation system, because the streetcar has to work with buses, it has to work with cars, works with airplanes and all the other stuff. There's a financial system, there's ways that it's funded. There is an environmental system, it emits waste or doesn't emit waste. There are all of these containing systems. So there are multiple containing systems for any part. And the question is, which one are you talking about? So often you get into these system thinking discussions, people focus on the boundary, but it's not just the boundary, it's what is the system, what is the part contained in. Second, explain the behavior property of the containing whole. Okay, so if we look at the way that, let's talk about the streetcar system, and the streetcar system is running slowly. Why is that? Well, you have to look at the constraints, and so there's a certain amount of provincial funding associated with this. So that could be the containing hole. To explain the behavior of property, the thing to be explained in terms of the role or function within the containing hole. So if the streetcars are not running frequently enough, it's because of the provincial funding. It's not because necessarily the driver is lazy or not paying attention or that sort of thing. So system thinking drives you towards synthesis, putting things together as opposed to taking things apart. And that's the trick. So when you're thinking about your service systems, the first question I'll ask is, were you asked to do an analysis? Or were you asked to put things together, a context for that?
Say synthesis, or look better.
So the service system you might want to look at is, you might look at the containing holes for that system, and then you can explain the system itself.
They were asked to do an analysis.
Asked to take things apart.
The assumption is they're already together.
Yeah, but this is why design thinking is popular. So in my other presentation, set of presentation slides, design thinking has both synthesis and analysis. And so that's why design thinking is popular, because it has synthesis part in it. It puts the system in the context. There's a categorization of systems that Acuff and Garajadagi had done. There's four types of systems, and they're in terms of purpose in the parts and holes. So we have a deterministic system that is not purposeful. The way you could read this is whether they have choice or not. So an engine is a part in a car. An engine doesn't choose to be an engine, and a car doesn't choose to be a car. They're machines, so there's no purpose in them. We have animated systems. So we are animated systems. Our heart doesn't choose to be a heart. As human beings, we can choose whatever destiny we want. Social systems, they have purpose in the parts. So each of us within Canadian federal system, we just had an election, have a choice, and then jointly, we can have a choice. And then you have an ecology that has choice in the parts, but not in the whole. So if you are in a ecology of a financial ecology, you might be able to manipulate one stock, but it's pretty hard to manipulate the whole stock market. You might be able to change the weather inside your house. You can't change the weather for the world. That's a basic categorization of types of systems. One of the problems we have with systems thinking is people use a lot of metaphors. And so you have the idea of the brain of a firm or the heart of the enterprise. And it's like, well, maybe not. You have to be careful with your metaphors in doing these sorts of things. But we start thinking about your service system. Where is the choice in your service system? Do you think your service system is a machine? Do you think your service system is like a human being? Do you think your service system is like a social system, has choice in parts and whole, or is your service system an ecology?
Ecology is used a lot in that terminology, the Spohr Maglio conversation. They talk about ecology.
They may or may not mean this, though.
I don't think they do.
Right. And this is the challenge. But if you think about biology and ecology, what's different to biology and ecology, you end up with these sorts of differentiations. Because ecology is much more about the environment and how those things work together.
I would be surprised if anybody's service system is not social in this definition.
So we can look at behaviors on the internet as an example. So
is that ecological? No.
The internet? You ever tried controlling the whole internet? Is there a direction for the whole internet?
Right, so it's ecological.
It's ecological, yeah.
So maybe some of yours will be
Now, on top of that, we add time, and time brings us into learning. Gregory Bateson had this categorization of types of learning, and the way that he did research on this after he's doing started looking at human beings, started with something simpler, started looking at porpoises, dolphins. Porpoises, I think, actually. And so he thought this idea, you have a dolphin, and you try to train the dolphin, and the dolphin doesn't respond to training. So you offer it a fish, there's no learning. It doesn't do anything different, right? Does your system have no learning? And that's the way that a lot of systems are designed, is that they're designed ideally. So this system should be designed perfectly, and it'll be ideal. It's like, well, if it's ideal, then does it ever change? It's like, well, no, ideal is absolute. So if you can get to the second, it's to learning one. Learning one, you have the dolphin, you train it, it does a trick, you give it a fish. It does a trick again, you give it a fish, right? So there's a specific response, you give it a set of alternatives, it does those, and you have what's called proto learning. You have the second case, learning two, doer learning. And what happens in this case, Bateson did was, he has the fish, he has the dolphin swim and does a trick, gives the fish. Now he wants the dolphin to learn, so he wants the dolphin to do a different trick. Dolphin comes back, does the same trick, no fish. Okay? Does it again, maybe there's a mistake here. Does the same trick again, no fish. Now it gets angry, it gets really annoyed, and it jumps out of the water, give it a fish. Jumps out of the water again, no fish. So the question will be, can the dolphin learn to learn? So you want to reward new behaviors, not the same behavior over and over again. Deuteral learning. So Argyris took this and called the single loop learning and double loop learning. But there's more. So there's learning three, treato learning. In this case, we're actually looking for learning at the next level. And this is an interesting question about whether you can get people to that third level. And in my discussion with my friend David Hawk, I figured out that I actually have done this. But what I do? I have four sons. What I did with my four sons is as they're graduating from grade 12, got them to apply to university like everybody else does. But then that was only to get information, because what we did is then they went to China for 2 years. We don't speak Chinese at home. So my sons were in China for 2 years, and their goals were, number one, learn the language, because you're never going to get another 2 years to learn a language in immersion. And the other thing is learn about the culture. And so I always had this rule. As soon as they arrive, I want you to do two things. One, get a mobile phone, get a SIM card so we can call you. And number two, open a bank account so we can send you money. Great. First thing, you know, they get there, they show up in the taxi, and they get to the university. They actually find someone to help them. Another student usually will come and help them. And so, you know, it takes like an hour, half an hour or something to go get a SIM card. So do that. Then the second one, opening a bank account. They go to the bank. It takes 6 hours in China to open a bank account. And they go, what? And I said, well, there's your first learning. The Canadian bank system is a really great banking system. You can open a bank account pretty quickly here. In China, it's not like that. And so it's a different environment, and what they got used to was being in China requires you to think entirely differently. The set of alternatives that you would normally have when you're in a double loop learning situation don't apply. You have to go into another set of learning. And so I've taken my sons, although I've taken two at a time, I took them to Japan with me, and so their first idea was, oh, Japan's going to be like China. Tokyo's going to be like Beijing. I go, no. So, but when they got there, they adapted pretty quickly, and now I have my youngest son go to Paris. Says, Paris is like ridiculously easy, because like we have French on the signs in Canada, so what's a big deal? It's not like going to Beijing where you can't read anything, right? So that is an example of treato learning, getting to a completely different environment, completely different set of alternatives. The last one, genetic change. Bateson believed that only nature can do that. There are changes that you cannot do consciously that only nature can change over a long period of time. So bring this back to service systems. When you are designing your service system, are you designing your service system to learn? If you are designing your service system to learn, at what level does it learn? I'm going to give you a break, but I want to get over two more slides, I think. How many people have ever seen how buildings learn? Okay, this is homework now. It actually will not be painful. You go to YouTube, type in How Buildings Learn. It's a BBC series, and the book is in the library. But the way that so Stuart Brand, who created the Whole Earth Catalog, wanted to study organizational learning. That was his goal. But how do you study organizational learning when, you know, it's a relatively new field and people have to define what learning is and all sort of stuff? So he decided to look at how buildings learn. And when he used the term learn, it's like I told you in the past one, because he knew Bateson. Bateson had written for the Whole Earth Review. And the way you think about this is people normally think about the occupants of the building as the system and the building as the containing system. Flip it around. Think of the building as the system and the people around it as the environment, as containing whole. Okay? And so with this, we end up with what's called pacing layers or shearing layers. Get an architecture again. And the way he describes is you have sight. So sight is the thing that changes the slowest. Talking about processes now. So it's eternal. You then have the structure. The structure is the load-bearing walls of a system. Outside, you put out the skin to protect the structure. Inside, you put in the services. So inside the load-bearing walls, you put in plumbing and electricity. And then you have the space plan. The space plan is non-load-bearing walls. You're just dividing up the space inside. And finally, you've got the stuff, which is furniture. And so the furniture changes rapidly. Now, this is the way that most buildings have been built conventionally. There are some exceptions. In the Pompidou Center in Paris, they put the services outside of the structure and outside the skin, which is not a good idea because then all the ducts rust and stuff like that. When you're talking about stuff versus space plan, you end up with questions about closet or armoire. So do you want to design a system where you put in an armoire or do you want to put in a closet? And what's the difference? So an armoire, when you leave the house, you can take it with you. A closet, you can't take it with you. But this is when we get into thinking about designing things in time. And we start talking about architecture in the true sense of architecture. Because when you're architecting, now you are partitioning up space or partitioning up time. And how do we do that? I'm going to close out here. We're going to innovate. And I like this description by Drucker. It says, innovation depends on what we call organized abandonment. And so the idea is to get the new and better things. You have to throw out the old, outworn, obsolete, no longer productive. And the medical saying is, as long as the patient eliminates the chance once the bowels and the bladder stop, death does not take long. So the way that I suggest looking at systems is not by adding stuff, but by subtracting stuff. Try removing things from a system and see if it helps. It's actually a philosophy of consulting. Whenever I'd come in and do this sort of work, I would always ask what it is that you're going to stop doing. Because people are already working 8 hours a day or more. And if they're going to do something else, then it's like, well, you have to stop doing something. So we actually need people to stop working on things. So let's take a short break, and we'll come back and work through the rest of the ideas.
So,
10 minutes. That good? Maybe at 11 minutes, my phone says 7:44. Come back.